where the news is never hidden and the truth wins every time. Today we have Andrew Herod and Todd Benzman joining us to share some incredible information with you. But this is a Christian news show, and we start with reading the Bible. So today we're starting with Hebrews 11, verses 30 and 31. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed about 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. Joshua gave directions to walk once around Jericho in silence for 6 days. He did this with the children of freedom. Not those who had been slaves, but their children who grew up relying on God to provide manna and more. They grew up seeing God's hand in everything that was provided. Their faith in the Lord grew as the Jordan River parted at flood height for them. And just as with the parting of the Red Sea, they walked across the riverbed on dry land. How could these walls come down? God. How could they win against an enemy that had never lost? God. These men went believing and beyond that, knowing that their God does impossible things. The walls of Jericho came down as they circled Jericho on the 7th day for the last time and shouted as Joshua asked. God did the impossible. They just believed God, and he was able to do that. Rahab the harlot converted in her heart to follow the God of the Jews, possibly even before the spies came. She told the truth of how the people of Jericho feared their God for his doing the impossible. Her faith in God allowed her to save her family. She was saved because she believed the Israelites would keep their promise. This woman of faith became one of the ancestors of Jesus of Nazareth. Having faith in God, this wonderful God who does impossible things, has its rewards. Dear Lord Jesus, you are the God who loved me first while I was yet in my sins. You gave all, even before I was thought of on this earth, so that I may have life. These great examples of faith, the Israelites at Jericho and Rahab believed you are the God who does impossible things. Lord, may I become one who lives what I believe. Lord, that you are the God who does impossible things. Now, I do want to get into this interview. So you're going to hear some incredible things. I'm just going to start this quicker on with the video audience and with the straight audio audience. I wish I could work it so it would work together, and I haven't found a way to do that. So let me get this started. This is one incredible amount of stuff that I have today, I have to say. My interview with Andrew was kind of eye-opening. I had read the news story, and that's why I asked him to come on. And Andrew Herod is one of our hosts on Black Talk Radio. He's on tomorrow. So after listening to this, you may want to catch his show tomorrow. So with that ado, I'm starting the video, and I will be starting the audio on BTR any second. And I thought I was starting the video. Did I do something wrong? If you cannot hear the video, please tell me. Oh, you probably can. I'm sorry. And this is the joy of having too many things to do. I am still on BTR. So this is taking a few minutes longer for me to set up with BTR. I've got to figure out how to do this a little faster. Usually I can do it within a few seconds, and this is taking me a little bit longer today. I don't know what's going on. Where we put our files for the video, for the audio files, is just not being cooperative for me to see very well. I don't know why. But that's it today. Trying to get where I want to see. I think I have too many, and I need to delete some. It's going the wrong direction. Come on. Here we go. And here we go. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to the Slut Lifting Report. You're one of the incredible writers that I enjoy listening, reading and listening to, because you are also a host with Blog Talk Radio and our wonderful Global Patriot Radio group. I read your article, Muslim Professor Claims Islamic Scholars Have Placed Too Much Emphasis on Jihad as Violent in Front Page Magazine, with some curiosity. I pride myself on thinking I stay up on a lot, but you always beat me. I had not even heard of Critical Connections. I'm curious about what brought them to your awareness.
Well, it's great to be on the show with you, Paul. I always enjoy talking with you and being interviewed by you. The particular group Critical Connections, which hosted this webinar with a Mount Holyoke College professor, Sohail Hashmi, professor of Islamic history and Islamic law, came to my attention simply through looking for these various events and as part of my writing, my work for the Middle East Forum with their Campus Watch. Campus Watch at the Middle East Forum focuses on critiquing, analyzing Middle East studies in the United States, at the world of academia, what it's saying about Islam, the West, Israel, what agendas are being promoted there, what sort of propaganda perhaps is taking place, what's the state of Middle East studies in general. And so we follow academic presentations like this of this professor from Mount Holyoke College, Sohail Hashmi, and we analyze them, we write about them to try to inform the larger public about what is being taught in the ivory tower academia, in Middle East studies, and about Islam in particular, and other related issues of Islam's relationship to the West and to Israel, and again, what agendas are being advanced? Are they sort of for American Western interests or against American Western interest, in general, a liberal worldview, right, advancing free societies, how is that being treated in Middle East studies? And so I came across this particular presentation just simply following social media. I can follow online various groups or on Twitter individuals, and they'll post whatever events are of interest to them or that they're involved in. This particular event I came across, I think it was on some Twitter account, someone was highlighting it, that this was an interesting event. And so I looked at it, and the Middle East Forum Campus Watch agreed that they thought they wanted to have this event covered. And so it was put on by this group I had not heard of before called Critical Connections, which is located in Western Massachusetts, near the Pioneer Valley or in that Pioneer Valley area, as it's called, of the Connecticut River. That's precisely where I went to school, at Amherst College in that area, which along with Mount Holyoke College is part of the so-called Five Colleges, this academic consortium of Amherst College, Mount Holyoke College, then Smith College in Northampton, and Hampshire College, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, the flagship University of Massachusetts campus. These all form the Five College Consortium in the Connecticut River Valley, the Pioneer River Valley, as it's called. And this Critical Connections group is out there. It's actually headed by an individual, South Asian individual, Pakistani-American individual, I believe, by the name of Maliki Samdani, who actually shares with me a similar degree at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I learned in our biography that she also went to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, an international relations program, indeed the nation's oldest international relations program. And she has a sort of a background in non-governmental organizations, NGOs, humanitarian work, and has in recent years formed this group called Critical Connections, which is interested in analyzing issues of Islam in the United States and the broader world. So she interviews people like this professor from Mount Holyoke College, and they discuss topics of concern to Muslims in the wider world.
Now, you mentioned her co-moderator, Malhaka Samdani, who is a Karachi University student. The person we're talking about is Rutaba Tariq. I'm sorry. And I find that interesting. We have a Pakistani university student here in the States, or is she?
She's as you indicated. She goes to Karachi University in Pakistan, and she called into the webinar participated from Pakistan itself. She's a Karachi University student, master student there in Pakistan, and has participated in what they call the Model Organization of Islamic Cooperation, a student organization for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, this 57-member nation international grouping, also including the nation of Palestine, the Palestinian territories are recognized as a nation in the OIC. And the OIC is indeed, with its, 56 nation states as well as this Palestine, but certainly with 56 Muslim majority recognized states, its largest international organization of the world outside of the United Nations. Only the United Nations is larger. And the OIC then forms within the United Nations a key voting bloc. If you think of particularly issues involving Israel, there's only one Jewish state, Israel, in the United Nations, but there are 56 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, headquartered in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
Wow. That's interesting. You state that Sohail Hashmi was the presenter, and the topic was really jihad. My question, after reading that, I was your piece on this, I found it very interesting because it was really comes out and says some important things. So was Professor Sohail Hashmi truly straightforward in telling the entire truth when he talked about jihad?
Well, he had a presentation where he was comparing and contrasting jihad, the Islamic concept of warfare, with the just war concept of warfare that with which people are familiar in the West, this Christian-developed doctrine, which has indeed become sort of the basis of international law on warfare, the rules of war that have sort of become the international norm, issues like not harming civilians and so forth, avoiding harm to civilians or treatment of prisoners and so forth, or the justifications for going to war. All of this was actually, as Hashmi himself indicated in the presentation, grew out of this Western Judeo-Christian just war theory. And that's become then the basis of modern international law. If you look to the United Nations Charter, the principle that you may only use military force for self-defense. Okay, you can't have wars of aggression. That's of course a basic just war principle that you may only engage in warfare for right intention. You have to have a moral intention of preserving life, protecting life. Saint Augustine, for example, in the 5th century, in his writings on theology, he wrote about just warfare being an act of love. That you may only engage in warfare precisely to protect human life. So that the violence of warfare is something that's sort of fundamentally to be avoided, fundamentally evil, but that avoidance, that imperative to avoid violence and to kill and destroy can be outweighed if you have a threat that is going to destroy, threaten human dignity, threaten human life. But so you have to engage in a moral inquiry about, is your use of force, that destruction that you're going to have in your use of force, going to be outweighed and therefore justified by a greater danger, a greater threat to human life? So that's sort of the basis of just war. I mean, in the presentation, he noted that the New Testament in the Bible, the Christian scriptures, are indeed very sort of pacifist inclined. I mean, Jesus never held any military political power. He lived his life as a shepherd. He emphasized peacemaking. I mean, he He said, you know, blessed are the peacemakers in the Sermon on the Mount. Also saying things like turn the other cheek and so forth. So there's a big emphasis in the New Testament on avoiding violence. So Christians have always had to struggle with warfare because there's such an emphasis in the New Testament on love and avoiding violence. So there is indeed a tradition of Christian pacifism. I mean, some Christians throughout history have chosen pacifism, that you just should simply renounce any force, any violence, and that's the command of Jesus. But the mainstream of Christian thinking has indeed been the just war tradition with which Christians have had to struggle, that and sometimes you do indeed precisely to love your fellow man as yourself, to protect human life, you have to resort to violence as a form of defense. I mean, just like domestically we have police forces, internationally we also have to have a use of force with the military at times in a fallen world to defend against aggressors. And you can see that, for example, as well in the New Testament, that Jesus never condemns soldiers. I mean, he meets with soldiers and so forth, like the Roman centurion he has a discussion with, but he never says to such soldiers, you know, don't be a soldier. You know, it's sinful to be a soldier. I mean, he merely says to like soldiers, you know, simply take your wages, don't extort things from people, don't engage in evil. And then later, of course, in Romans, in chapter 13 of Romans, the Apostle Paul has perhaps the key text on government for Christians, that government is the sword bearer, that Christians have to respect the government, the state, as a sword bearer that's there to uphold the good and to protect people from wrong. So the instrument of the state has this protective function for Christians. So he indicated that in the presentation, and also indicated there as well that in jihad, the main objective for Muslims is to advance Islamic law, to advance and promote an Islamic state and this Islamic rule. And the thinking in Islam historically, classically, has been that Islamic law, Sharia, this Islamic state, really is this divinely mandated law, and it's really what God wants for humanity. It's really the best law, the best society, and so it's really a blessing for all of humanity. So therefore, Muslims should want to, as they would see it, liberate humanity by bringing them all under Islamic law, under Sharia. And that's why precisely historically in Islam, the term for Islamic conquest is precisely the Arabic fatah, which literally means opening. And that's indeed today the largest group in the Palestinian Liberation Organization has always been fatah, which in Arabic means opening, which is this concept that we're opening the world to Islam, which is therefore a form of liberation, right? If we conquer Spain or the Holy Land or whatever, we're opening that part of the world to Islam and to Islamic rule, and the people there will benefit from that. So he indicated that. I think, however, he comes from a Muslim background himself. I think he sort of was shading things in his presentation in a real favorable sense towards Islam, because those are then two fundamentally different goals in just war on the one hand and Islamic law on the other hand, that the purpose of just war is this universal protection of all human life. So if you think of, like, say, World War II, if you're fighting the Nazi regime, to fight the Nazis and to protect people, say, like the Jews from genocide, or the peoples of the Soviet Union from enslavement, to destroy this power, the Third Reich, that's endangering Europe and particularly in the wider world with its conquest, that has nothing to do with any particular religion or belief system or particular form of law, right? There's a general principle there, protect all human life, as depicted in movies like, you know, Saving Private Ryan by Steven Spielberg, where you have Catholics and Protestants and Jews fighting in the American army, this American squad and their infantry squad. They're all fighting for, in this combined goal together against the Germans and the Nazis, just for this general principle of human freedom. In contrast, in jihad, you know, you're really advocating this sectarian law, this theocracy, all under the assumption that, oh, this is really a blessing. This is really the best form of governance. This is the best religion, the final faith. And so you're just assuming that Islam is really true and the best government. And so you're now going to fight in the name of that religion. So, and you're willing to use force in the name of that belief system, of that law, which, as history has shown, can be very brutal force. And as he himself indicated in his presentation, there's often thinking in Islam that this glorious end of Sharia justifies the means, so I can engage in, you know, terrorism or whatever I got to do to advance this glorious end of Sharia. So that those are really two fundamentally different goals.
It's interesting. The opening part I think I've seen it a couple times, but it kind of surprises me to think that they would almost state that the opening is not part of jihad or fatah, as you're saying. The definition of jihad in, you know, is the war on non-Muslims. So it's interesting.
Well, he made that argument precisely in the classical thinking and the historic thinking. Now, he argued that precisely Muslims themselves in the modern world, he said, you know, are such wars in the name of jihad, is that compatible with modern international law, like in the United Nations Charter, which, as you said, is really sort of the final outgrowth of just war thinking. If you think of modern international law, as he was indicating, Sohail Hashmi from Mount Holyoke College, it really is at its base a Western creation, right? So it really comes out of this Judeo-Christian Western civilization. So at its root is really this biblical thinking. And so therefore, this Judeo-Christian just war thinking, which, you know, neither in the Jewish scriptures nor in the Christian scriptures is there any mandate to use violence conquer other people and convert them or bring them under a sectarian rule. I mean, Jews, on the one hand, are not interested in conquering other people to bring them under Jewish rule or to make them Jewish or anything. And then again, in the Christian scriptures, with this belief in this Jewish Messiah, Jesus, there again, there's this emphasis on peace among all human beings. I mean, the late great Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, the British rabbi who died just this year or earlier this year, or I guess, yeah, earlier this year it was, he noted in one of his presentations that in Judaism there's always sort of these two poles, that on the one hand you have a particular Jewish people that has its own unique Jewish culture, a Jewish religious law, but then Judaism believes that all of humanity is made in God's image, and that Jews have a mission from God to be a light unto the nations, that, to uphold this universal morality. And so Judaism teaches precisely that all of the world has to learn how to live with unique nations, on the one hand, having their own cultures, but on the other hand, they live according to a universal law of human dignity, so of equality. So the different nations have to learn how to live together as equals. That biblical thinking, and so and therefore in the Jewish scriptures, there you have a lot of warfare and a lot of violence. But the Jewish scriptures teach that such violence is always justified only as part of God's vengeance against evil. Like God condemns the pagan tribes, the Canaanites in the Holy Land, because they've done so many disgusting things and offended God, and he tells the Jews, you know, go in there and clean it out, you know, and expel these people from this land. And Jewish teaching from, say, the Talmud says that even in fighting, say, the pagan tribes, where God says go in and just wipe them out, that even there, the Jews had to leave some sort of way of escape for such pagans to get away, right? If they want to just run away and just leave the Holy Land, and then we take over the Holy Land, this promised land for Jews, they can, and we'll not pursue them, right? So we'll only fight them if they stay. Even there's a moral teaching that we're not supposed to, you know, you're supposed to allow the option of retreat, the option of people to get away, but there, you know, the violence of the Jews is presented as being part of God's vengeance, like, say, the vengeance of God in the flood of Noah, right? That their times, or the vengeance of God on ancient Egypt when they refused to let the Jews go, the 10 plagues. I mean, you know, even in the Jewish scriptures, violence it has a moral teaching. There's a moral reason for violence, that there's been some great evil. It's not because, you know, God wants, say, violence to be used for the Jews to go out to try to convert people to any belief system, any religion or particular law, but it's only, again, this punishment of evil.
Yeah.
You know, that's fundamentally different from this jihad teaching. And Hashmi himself indicated that modern Muslim scholars have had to try to reanalyze this tradition to try to bring it in conformity with what we accept in the modern world today in international law, based on this just war, that you can't have wars of aggression anymore.
I'm curious how he's here in the West. I'm curious how his did the Pakistani moderator, did she kind of fight back with us a little bit, or?
Well, see, both he and also the moderator, Malika Samdani, here in the United States, is this South Asian Pakistani-American woman. So, you know, both of these individuals are very Western, as well as the other individual you indicated at Karachi University. You know, she was also very much from a sort of a Western background, part of sort of like the Westernized elite of Pakistan, right? I mean, the elite of Pakistan going to these universities would often be come from a Western tradition. And so they would be precisely the kind of people with whom you could argue. I mean, this Malika Samdani, as I indicated before, you know, she went to the Fletcher School like I did, right? So,
yeah.
You know, all the people at the Fletcher School are very much from this kind of, you might say, you know, globalist background. You know, they're, you know, all the people we get there, it's a very international school with people all over the world, but they all share this very kind of, you know, elite, you know, you might call it kind of like a Davos World Economic Forum mindset, you know, commitment to like international cooperation, international law, international norms. I mean, these are all precisely the kind of people who would later go to the United Nations or, you know, international organizations or serve in diplomatic corps and so forth. So at least the ambiance of the school is this idea of like the United Nations, the sort of the ideals of the United Nations of human rights and international law and respect for norms. And I mean, you'd have people there from like the Chinese Communist Party, you know, their diplomatic service and so forth. You know, one of my roommates was once a Chinese foreign ministry official. You know, all these people, of course, are in the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, you know, they might not, you know, their presentation of human rights or international law, of course, is not going to ultimately be a very Western presentation, but at least they'll at least talk the language, or they'll at least try to operate within that framework, right? I mean, that's the, you know, you can go, yeah.
Is that part of what happened? Do you think that's part of what happened, that this is where I get a little interested with this coverage? Did Sohail Hashmi, I mean, he sounds like he tried to smooth out or lessen what jihad actually means. So that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, I think you're obviously right, and that would be a point of suspicion, that, you know, he was obviously grasping for a sort of a modern understanding of Islam, modern understanding of jihad, and he mentioned how, you know, modern Muslim scholars have had to grapple with this and have tried to look at the doctrine of Islam and try to reinterpret it so jihad would be understood as merely defensive warfare. I mean, he himself, for example, argued that he believed that according to Islamic doctrine, weapons of mass destruction, in particular nuclear weapons, should not be permitted. You know, you saw that was mentioned in the article. You know, I think that's a questionable issue. I mean, if we think about it, I mean, Pakistan, of course, precisely where this co-moderator was coming in from, Pakistan, since 1998, has its own declared nuclear deterrent, which before then was undeclared. You know, Pakistan has developed nuclear weapons. And then, of course, we have the Islamic Republic of Iran, even more worryingly in recent decades has of course had this nuclear program and has shown really every indication to develop nuclear weapons and to deploy them on missiles, and there doesn't seem to be any great pushback from Muslims there saying you know that's not Islamic or you shouldn't do that. He was arguing on this principle that, well, in Islamic law, there is indeed a significant body of literature that says that you can't harm civilians. Okay, so you have to, there's a distinction between combatants and non-combatants, like in just war, right? That, in just war, you're supposed to protect life, right? Which means that you have to try to avoid killing non-combatants. You may only use that violence that is necessary to achieve the objective of peace, of defeating an enemy, defeating a threat. So you're supposed to aim at just the combatants. You're not supposed to just go out and kill civilians. I think there's a lot to be said there. I think it's far murkier than what he presented. For example, Robert Spencer himself has noted that, there are different hadiths, these canonical sayings about the life of Muhammad that sort of indicate differing perspectives on whether you can kill civilians or not. There's some hadith that indicate, like, when he and his Islamic army attacked the Khaybar oasis, this Jewish oasis, in the 7th century Arabian Peninsula, that Muhammad just gave orders of going in for a night attack, said, look, just kill anyone, and if you can't really tell if someone's a civilian or not because it's night, whatever, who cares? They're just all part of the same community. Just go in and kill. You have also the there's really been no, if you think of Hamas, or Hezbollah, they are indeed terrorist groups, and they've engaged in all manner of terrorist attacks, of suicide bombing. Just recently, once again, all these indiscriminate mass rocket attacks, right? And you don't hear from the Muslim world, any great outcry against Hamas or Hezbollah.
Was it 10 or 20% of those rockets fall on their own people?
Falling on their own people, so they don't seem particularly concerned about their own people getting killed. When I was doing research, there's this, sometimes you hear about this famous, fatwa against suicide bombing that was supposedly put out, it was back in like 2014 or so.
Yes.
and put out by this, Pakistani Muslim who now lives in the United Kingdom. I'm trying to remember his name. He heads this, Minhaj, what's it called again? Institution in Pakistan. So he put out this fatwa that supposedly was supposed to say that suicide bombing's wrong. And I read it and wrote an article about it for Jihad Watch, and showed that it really didn't say that. I mean, for one thing, all the references to suicide in this fatwa, they merely talk about suicide in the normal sense that someone kills themselves because they're like depressed or something. And Islam, of course, is against that, as it's a biblical teaching. Your life is sacred. You're not supposed to kill yourself. But groups like Hamas, they don't view suicide bombing or what we call suicide bombing as a form of suicide, but they view them precisely as martyrdom operations, shahid operations. I mean, they really view them as the same way the Japanese viewed kamikaze attacks in World War II, that you're not committing suicide, but rather you're just engaging in an attack which the nature of it is such that it costs you your life, right? That
it causes you to go to glory in their belief structure.
Right. You become a martyr, but it's really just a manifestation of what the Catholic Church in moral teaching calls double effect, right? That your primary effect, your primary intent is to inflict harm on the enemy. But it simply has the double effect in the way you conduct the attack, that you conduct the attack in a suicidal mission such that you conduct the attack that you really have no practical hope of escape. You're going to die. But, that's no different from, say, kamikaze pilots in World War II, or indeed many other people, Americans or Western soldiers have also engaged in missions where you go on some attack and you know that there's very little chance you're going to come out alive. You're going to hold a position or something. Or, for example, that
my biggest issue with that whole strain is that these are not in general, people following this doctrine generally do not wear uniforms. They do not belong to a particular military entity. They present themselves sometimes as civilians.
Right.
So the concept of just attacking the military just kind of flies out there.
Well, that's another principle of just war, in distinguishing sort of a derivative principle of just war that has historically been accepted, that in order to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, combatants have to identify themselves and wear uniforms. And you have to separate yourself from the non-combatants. I mean, precisely with Hamas, they're using these human shields, right? They're mixing all of their military facilities within civilians. You're not supposed to do that. That's a war crime. You are indeed supposed to try to separate yourself, because otherwise I can't fight my enemy without killing civilians. So there's, and precisely as you're saying with state suicide bombers, you go in as a civilian and you engage in these terrorist attacks, and I can't tell who is going to attack me or not. But all these tactics, as Hashmi himself indicated in his presentation, have been justified by the Islamic principle of necessity, of darura, as it's said in Arabic, that, again, yes. if as he indicated, that, you know, if this end of Sharia, if that's your ultimate goal, is Sharia, this glorious Islamic state, this is glorious Islamic law, whereas the ultimate end in just war, in contrast, is precisely the preservation of human life. See, so there's a fundamental flaw, I guess, in his thinking, or the fundamental division between Islamic warfare, jihad, and this just warfare tradition developed by Christians, which has become the basis of modern international law, is that just warfare has the basic goal of protecting human life, right? Whereas Islamic warfare has the basic goal of advancing this ideology of Islam, and it actually doesn't really – human life is secondary to that goal. You know, who cares about –
That, to me, is the most important thing to understand. Everything
right.
else is secondary to that goal.
Right, so you can –
I'm running out of time for what I've got to do. I want to say, Andrew, please tell everybody, you know, about your show and about your work and how they can support you in your work.
Oh, well, you can read more of these such writings. I'm, as I said before, a Campus Watch Fellow for the Middle East Forum. My writing appears at all sorts of outlets in conjunction with the Middle East Forum. Like American Spectator, Breitbart, Daily Caller, Daily Wire. I also write independently for other individuals for specific projects, my writings appeared at the National Interest and American Thinker, and I also used to write for the Institute of Religion and Democracy at their Juicy Ecumenism website. And my writing has also appeared at the Religious Freedom Coalition and Washington Times. And also I'm a contributor as well at Jihad Watch. So if you go to Jihad Watch, you can see my writing there. I just had an article come out today, a book review on a book about Pope Pius V.
I'm just waiting for the
Holy League that fought at the Battle of Lepanto in 1571 against the Ottoman Empire's fleet and defeated them there. That's 450 years ago in this anniversary year of 2021 on October 7th, 1571. So you can read me also at Jihad Watch, as well as you've indicated, I'm a fellow presenter with you at Global Patriot Radio, where I have a show called Conservative Casual Friday, where I like to interview individuals every Friday on important events of the week. For conservatives or others, you can tune in on Friday, or you can listen to the podcast later, upload it online, and follow the interesting conversations I have with guests who come in to discuss important issues of the day there.
I say definitely you want to turn into Andrew's show. I do occasionally, and I test the quality of the guests make a difference. And I want to say thank you for that work. I'm enjoying listening to your show as well. Thank you, Andrew. I'll have to have you back soon.
All right, then. Thanks for having me, Paul. Till next time.
Now we're back, and I have to say that was an interesting interview. Andrew usually doesn't, I would say, banter that for – I was trying to get at the that this guy who presented wasn't presenting the whole truth. And Andrew did that in his own unique way of presenting it, that he understands where the guy comes from. But again, he has this, he has a, believe it or not, he has Christian influence by living around Christians. And the concept of just war exists in Christendom and Judaism, but it may not exist in Islam. He may want it to, but it simply does not. I'm talking about not Andrew Herod saying that, but I'm talking about the guy who presented saying that. That's the truth. And, you know, when you look things up, I'm going to tell you again, if you want to learn more about this topic, go to Amazon.com and buy my latest book, The Cancer of Civilization Jihad. You will learn more about the social norms of Islam than you ever expected to. I only list 20 of them, but jihad is the last topic. And I will tell you, do not skip to that. The reason I tell you that is because there are pieces before it that are instrumental in the buildup to understanding the concept of jihad. So if you look at all these little things, they add up, and that's what becomes instrumental. It's rather shocking. Now, the next thing I have is I also had a chance to interview Todd Bensman, who I've been trying to get back on. And Todd is a busy guy, and he works for the Center of Immigration for Immigration Studies. He goes where the story is and gets the truth often long before others can truly comprehend it. Todd's work on immigration and the border issues is not controversial at all. He brings a reminder that national security is not political. It is American. Now, I have to say, this is extremely important concept to understand. And why do I say that? Well, if you looked at, well, you got to change policies because now you have a Democrat in or a Republican in. You shouldn't be doing that in respect to national security. Not once, not ever. And that's the important part to understand. National security is never, should never be political. Up until this president, I think that was true in many ways, even, believe it or not, under Obama. If you read Todd's book, America's Covert Border Wars, you will find, you know, the things that I had thought would stand against that. Todd has evidence that this was the way things were. It surprised me. So I'm going to recommend you buy his book. So with that said, I want to play the interview. Now, I'll just do this a little quicker this time. I'm going to put this video up. This video, I just did this yesterday. And I have to say, what you're going to see is Todd's an amazing guy. That's all I can say. Wait till you see this. Here we go. And that's for the stream. And going back to getting this ready for Blog Talk Radio, and I just pushed that button. Here we go. Welcome to the Sutliffian Report. I'm glad to have you back. It's been a while since I've had you on, but I have to admit, even though I believe I'm informed, you always seem to shock me. Your article last week actually scared me. I know we have talked about Biden's pro-illegal immigration stance being destructive to America, but your article, Historic Surge of Extracontinental Immigrants Now Pouring Through Panama to the U.S. Border. I mean, that's a huge distance, too. it revealed something really scary at a whole new level to me. And could you tell us what you learned about the Darien Gap and the Jungle Passage between Colombia and Panama and what that means for us?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me again. And I know it's been a while. Most Americans are familiar with the typical Central American crossing over the Rio Grande River or, you know, in Arizona, California. But it's really the crisis that we're in the midst of right now. It goes far beyond the three Northern Triangle countries. The vice president just returned from Guatemala. a lot of the attention and focus is on those three countries because probably the majority of immigrants that are breaching the southern border are from those countries. But what gets lost in all of that mix is the fact that there are immigrants coming from all over the world who are answering the Joe Biden administration's la invitación, the invitation to cross the border, especially if you're a family. And so what we're seeing happen is thousands of immigrants from 150 countries are coming to the southern border in addition to the Central Americans, in addition to all the people that the Mexicans that you typically see. And the way they do that is they first fly into South America, like Brazil or Ecuador, Argentina, Peru, and then they have to travel through Panama to get into the so-called the Gulf Stream, I guess, of immigration, which is up through the Central American countries and Mexico. In order to get from South America to Panama, they have to travel through what's called the Darien Gap, which is a vast, lawless, ungoverned jungle that is ruled mainly by armed militias and human smugglers, and it's a very dangerous 10-day, 12-day trek through that wilderness under guided, they're not really Mexican cartels, but they're area groups that smuggle people through and guide them into Panama. Right now, that gap is stuffed to the gills with people on their move, on the move to the United States. And when I say people, the official government parlance is extracontinentals because they're coming in from a different hemisphere, other continents like Africa, lots of Africans, Middle Easterners. I talk a lot about Middle Easterners. I write a lot about the Middle Easterners coming. That's how they come through the Darien Gap into Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, and all the way up. I wrote this piece based on eyewitness accounts to journalists who were in the Darien Gap, Chuck Holton and Michael Yan, who I respect greatly. Those two guys are always on the ground in the middle of it. And they brought in a U.S. congressman. They actually brought two in. I'm only naming one of them at this point. Wisconsin Congressman Tom Tiffany, who went down there on his own dime with Michael Yan and Chuck Holton, and they went into the jungle, into the Indian villages where these migrants are spilling out from the Darien Gap into, often with tales of people that died along the way, a lot of bodies left behind on that trail. All incentivized to take that trail trip by the promises of Joe Biden. So in my view and on their view, it's on Biden's shoulders that these people are coming in such great numbers. They said that there are 10,000 by their estimation that came through just in May.
Wow.
And to give you a little perspective on that, 10,000 is usually the total number in a regular full year through the Darien Gap. Here you've got it in a single month, and it's going to stay like that for a long time. The national security problem with that kind of immigrant as opposed to your typical Central American is that they're coming from places like Pakistan and Yemen and Syria and Iraq and Iran and all of those terrorism countries of national security concern. So that's what the story was about. That's why I wrote it. I've often written about the Darien Gap, and I've been down into the Darien province myself, too. It's been a while, but I've reported there, too.
Wow. You already mentioned this. You've been sharing with us your observations on things on both sides of the border. What's changed recently?
Well, it depends on what you mean by recently. It depends on where you go on the border, but Those extracontinental migrants that I just talked about are coming now through the Del Rio sector. They're all headed here, but large numbers of very diverse kinds of immigrants from nationalities that you would never imagine, Senegal and Sri Lanka and, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo are coming through the Del Rio sector right now. And also, the other thing that's changed is that you're having large numbers of single adults crossing through the Big Bend area of all different nationalities who are coming to take advantage of the fact that there is almost no border patrol defending the Big Bend area. And they're on these long journeys through the wilderness of that area to reach Interstate 10, which is the east-west artery into the United States. Once you're on I-10, the smugglers have somebody pick you up in a truck or a van or a vehicle and drive you to Chicago or Florida or New Jersey or wherever you want to go. And the numbers of single adults coming through the Big Bend area are 400-500% higher than they've ever been. So that's kind of a new and interesting thing that's happening along the southern border. Every sector, every part of the border, it has its own unique characteristics that attract their own unique demographic. So in the Rio Grande Valley sector in southern Texas, that's where you see a lot of the families crossing over in huge numbers, tens of thousands, because it's easier and they are being allowed in and being legalized almost, you know, instantly when they reach, a border patrol station. So every area is a little bit different.
I don't think I'd seen the part about the single males coming in. Yeah. That strikes a similarity in what's been happening to Europe, and almost the vast majority, and maybe about 80-90% of the Muslim migrants of primarily North Africa coming into Europe, and they are again about 90 to 80% at the least single males, and that is changing the huge population, the population in Europe as a whole. So I was wondering if you think there's any similarity there as well.
Well, there's an inherent risk in the fact that you have single military-aged men crossing who do not want to be caught. They are evading, whereas the families cross over and they just sit there and wait to get caught they turn themselves in voluntarily. They want to be caught because they're going to get legalized right away. But the single adults are still being pushed back into Mexico by the Biden administration under the pandemic-related Title 42. So they don't want to get caught. And you have to wonder, among military-aged men, what their histories and backgrounds are. The majority of them are eventually going to get through undetected and into the nation's interior. And that's always a scary proposition to when you have young men of any nationality crossing into the country and just reaching the interior undetected. And that's happening in very increasing numbers.
That's really scary. I know that I would ask, I normally would ask you, is there anything we can do to fix this? But we're not in that place where anything can, we don't have a government that will do what's right. That's where we're stuck.
Yeah. I mean, the question is like, how much of this can even the Democrats stand? At what point is it too much? How many people are going to be allowed to come in? Millions and millions. I mean, it's just, that's the question. It's not that it's not stoppable. You can stop this. Trump showed that you can really tamp those numbers down by deterrence-based policies of returning people to Mexico automatically to apply for asylum there, to not let people come in on the honor system. I'll report to my nearest immigration office in Chicago, Scouts Honor. Those kinds of policies are highly incentivizing and motivating. Trump's policies were highly disincentivizing and deterring. Nobody wanted to live the great Mexican dream. They didn't come to live in Mexico. In fact, as I wrote the other day, most of the migrants, the extracontinentals that are coming in through the Darien Gap, are people that had been living in peace, security, and relative prosperity for years in South American countries, Brazil, Peru, Chile, Argentina, those kind of countries, because they knew they didn't have a chance when Trump was in office, so they just stayed where they were. Now they're just trading up. So those people already have – they're not coming from Haiti. They're coming from Chile or Brazil or Guyana or someplace else where they've been living already not under duress. So a lot of those people that are coming in are fairly prosperous. They just want to be more prosperous. And every one of them will apply for political asylum as though they would be persecuted if they were sent back to Haiti, where they haven't lived in years.
That's an important point. I want to say thank you. Please do not stop your work. I'm expecting one of your next articles to be is, do they really report in as they say they will?
I do want to tell you, I'll leave you with one other thing, Paul, is that there are some interesting things happening in the state of Texas right now, where the governor is and the Texas Department of Public Safety are responding to this border crisis in their own way. The Texas Department of Public Safety has rushed hundreds and hundreds of state troopers down to the border to plug the gaps and to start bringing charges against illegal immigrants for criminal trespass, child endangerment, smuggling. They're busting smugglers now. And some of the county sheriffs are doing the same thing. It could be that over the balance of 2021, that we see the state of Texas provide the deterrence-based policies that the feds won't, that the Biden White House won't. So keep an eye on that. There's even a proposal out there for the state to finish the wall in Texas.
Wow. Whoa. Now that wouldn't be a surprise. Texas, I never cease to be surprised in what they can do when the feds don't step up. Thank you again, Todd. I don't want to forget, tell people where they can follow your work tell them more about the Center for Immigration Studies.
Sure. Well, most of my work can be found at cis.org, that's Center for Immigration Studies, and also toddbensman.com. It's my portfolio website. And I have a book, America's Covert Border War, which is available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble for those of you who don't like Amazon, or anywhere that books are sold online or even at bookstores.
Thank you. We'll have to have you back soon. God bless.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to push that button. I always enjoy my time interviewing Todd. He's a friend, and his work is amazing. I do want to encourage you to go buy that book, America's Covert Border Wars. It has a lot of surprises in there. I can't say enough for this book. It's, like I said, it has surprises in there, things that you will not expect that make you go, oh, I wish I'd known that before. Like I said, I try to keep up on a lot of stuff, but he just amazes me with the stuff he researches. He goes and gets the story. That's what I love about Todd. He doesn't his work is just foundational in the fact that he actually goes, gets the story, and it's a firsthand tale. It's not, well, I heard about it. But he does do some of those with secondhand tales, but I'd say the vast majority of his work, recent work, is incredible because it's right there. He's interviewing the migrants. Wow. I want to get into a different topic that I have yet to have talked about on this show. And my reason has been I have avoided this topic because I haven't really done any research on it. I'm a retired teacher, and some things just disgust me. I'm talking about critical race theory. So I'm going to cover some things on this over the next few shows. I'll have more information than I do today. But I wanted to start out today by sharing a video that was made by a Chinese American who survived Mao's Cultural Revolution. Now, if you went to high school in the last 10 to 20 years, you will remember teachers like me hammering home the horror of the Cultural Revolution. This woman survived the Cultural Revolution, came and spoke to a school board about the dangers of CRT, this critical race theory. So I'm going to put this in the video room quickly first, and then I will move and put it in the audio room. This is it's very short video, but again, it is shocking. All right, so I'm just going to hit, there we go, and for BTR, here we go.
I've been very alarmed about what's going on in our school. You are now training our children to be social justice warriors and to loathe our country and our history. Growing up in Mao's China, all this seems very familiar. The communist regime used the same critical theory to divide people. The only difference is they use class instead of race. During the Cultural Revolution, I witnessed students and teachers again turn against each other. We changed school names to be politically correct. We were taught to denounce our heritage. The Red Guards destroy anything that is not communist, oaths, statues, books, and anything else. We are also encouraged to report on each other, just like the Student Equity Ambassador Program and the Bias Reporting System. This is indeed the American version of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. The critical race theory has its roots in cultural Marxism. It should have no place in our schools.
You can't say any more than that. This is just teaching another form of racism. I am disgusted with the whole concept. And as a former teacher, a special education teacher in the public schools, I'm not surprised that I see this coming in. I have been, as a teacher, I was subjected to claims that white teachers can't teach black teachers. I was subjected to claims that, all white people are racist. And then I was subjected to claims that, well, black people can't be racist because they're black. Yeah. And that's as a professional. What I mean is some of these things were said at staff meetings. Some of these things were said in the hallway to me by other professional educators. So you sit there. Yeah, I get disgusted with this concept. So let me tell you that there is some good news in respect to this horrible, horrible concept of CRT. Here we go. This is a story that came out of LifeSite News. It's on a Ohio bill that would ban critical race theory. It protects teachers from being forced to push gender dogma. Now, listen closely. Again, this came out yesterday from LifeSite News. I'm really, really happy about this article. It's by Calvin Freiberger, or Freiberger. It's fried. Ohio is the latest state in which lawmakers have introduced legislation to ban the teaching of far-left critical race theory, CRT, in public schools. Time with the added step of protecting a teacher's right to refuse to promote gender-fluid ideology. HB 322 forbids school officials from requiring that educators discuss current events or widely debated and currently controversial issues of public policy or social affairs, and requires that teachers who choose to do so strive to explore such issues from diverse and contending perspectives. Requiring students to engage in political lobbying or protesting for class credit or teaching that any race or sex is inherently superior, shameful, or oppressive, that members of different races shouldn't engage each other in a color-blind manner, that present members of one race bear responsibility for the past crimes of others, that hard work is a concept inherently belonging to or at odds with any one race, or that slavery was not merely a grievous sin of past Americans, but was fundamentally intertwined with the United States founding principles. It also bars school districts from accepting private funds for the purpose of curriculum development, purchase of selection of curricular materials, teacher training, professional development, or continuing teacher education on history, civics, or political related subjects, and ensures that teachers cannot be forced to affirm a belief in the systemic nature of racism or like ideas, or in the multiplicity of fluidity of gender identities or the like ideas, the teacher's sincerely held religious or philosophical convictions. The government is giving that to teachers as a kind of save yourself from getting fired for not believing in transgender rights. LGBT activist Daniel Terbasi complained to CBS affiliate WKBN, but one of the bill's authors, Republican State Representative Don Jones, responded that HB 322 is an anti-discrimination bill that promotes equality. Anything to the contrary is wrong. The bill reinforces teachers' basic rights that they not be compelled by the government to adopt any belief systems and indoctrinate their students with those teachings. The bulk of the new language is meant to quash the taxpayer-subsidized propagation of critical race theory, a doctrine that asserts race is socially constructed. Yeah, the color of your skin is socially constructed, huh? Culturally invented, a category that is used to oppress and exploit people of color, and that law and legal institutions of the United States are inherently racist insofar as they function to create a mainstream social, economic, and political inequalities between whites and non-whites, especially African Americans. Yeah, on that respect, we had a black president who served not one term, but two terms. He was reelected. He was reelected by states that had 90% white population. So, yes, what does that say for this claim that states are inherently racist? Yeah. I have another video I'm going – and an audio I will play for you next week. I just didn't correctly loaded up, so I'm going to skip that one. So the ones, I want you to think about this. The only good thing that I've heard about with critical race theory, if you call it good, it's more sad than good, that it's doing in school districts is revealing the racism of school board members. Now, that, I think, is inherently good. I mean, if you're going to have school board members, people should know who those people are. In general, school board members don't have they might be, in general, they might have a good education. But at the same time, they may be just as racist, and that's the reason why the critical race theory gets into your school district. That is generally my personal belief, that wherever CRT gets in, your school board members are racist. Guess how that gets in? Think about it. who approves it? Oh, could it be the school board? It doesn't matter if you have one person recommending this as a curriculum guy. Who's going to approve this? The school board. Keep thinking about that. The Washington Free Beacon caught some very disturbing things on this vein. The Boston school board members resigned after racist text messages emerged. Lorna Rivera told a colleague she was sick of white parents. Now, this article is by Alex Nestor. He writes, two Boston school board members resigned after text messages surfaced in which they said they were sick of the district's delusional white parents. Former Boston school committee member Lorna Rivera said she was sick of Westie Whiteys in a text message she sent to fellow former board member Alexandra Oliver Davila during a committee meeting on admissions policies. The Boston Globe reported on Monday, whatever, they're delusional. Oliver Davila said in a reference to parents from Boston's West Roxbury neighborhood, wait until the white racists start yelling at us, Rivera said in another text. Rivera resigned on Friday, this past Friday, according to the Globe. Rivera and Olivier Davila sent the text during an October 21st meeting on admissions processes for the district's three elite high schools. The committees voted to scrap the traditional admissions exam for a system that allocated seats based on a student's grades and zip code, which members thought would give priority to students in lower-income communities. Parents from West Roxbury objected to the proposal, which cut admissions from the wealthy neighborhoods. Rivera, a professor of women's studies at the University of Massachusetts, what did we hear that earlier today? Could that be where that Muslim professor was out of that area? Oh, yes. Think about that. Said in a statement to the Globe that the release of the messages constitutes a right-wing coordinated effort to stop the board from making the October admissions change permanently. The text obtained through an open records request were not the first racially charged messages to stem from the meeting. Former committee member Michael Lucanto caught in a hot mic before the meeting mocking the names of Asian parents who signed up to speak. Lucanto resigned the following day. The Globe said it's unclear why the messages were only made public this week. The messages considered public records under state law were redacted from the transcript that Boston Public Schools initially sent the Globe, which the paper noted could violate state law. The paper filed an open records request on October 22nd, asking for all emails and text exchanges between the board members that had occurred during the meeting. The Boston Herald filed a request for the same documents at the end of May, which the district has not yet completed. Oh, are you catching this? So they're not, I mean, they're breaking the law to protect themselves. This is scary, scary stuff. Boston Public Schools Director of Communications, Xavier Andrews, called the messages disappointing and hurtful in a statement to the Washington Free Beacon and said that he will continue to work to dismantle barriers to opportunities in the district. Oh, so the system was against white people? Is that what Boston is claiming? He just mentioned, okay, we talked about people insulting white people and people being racist against Asians. So the systemic barriers are against whites and Asians now. So this concept of systemic barriers, it's a big scam on the American public. And I'm sorry that we are putting up with it. I don't know why some people are foolish enough to believe it. Going on, I want to talk a little bit about the insanity of COVID-19 life. I've just been more disgusted with the COVID-19 plandemic. I'm calling it a plandemic now at this point because I think a lot of this is basically due to the incredible lies of one man, Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci should have his medical license revoked, in my opinion. When you give fake medical opinions, falsified data, and using falsified data and falsified information, that's how you get your medical license pulled. If you lie to your patients, you get your medical license pulled. If you create something called if you do something called malpractice, you get. Now, let's think about that. What he's been doing has been lying. He's been misinforming. And has he created problems in this country as a result? Well, we can go so far as to say that if it is not treason, it is awful close. Governor Newsom this week, he's capitalizing on this plandemic. Oh, my gosh. Governor Newsom this week on the June 3rd extended, I think it was actually June 5th, extended his emergency powers and mask mandates in the state of California. So he is the only one who makes choices in California. We didn't put up with that. Eventually we kicked out King Andy, but King Andy still has, he's still governor, but he should have been removed as the man behind a mass murder. He's not alone in that decision. He has with him a medical doctor, Dr. Zucker. Now, if he can claim, Dr. Zucker can claim that these decisions were made without him, he should go public today. But if they were made with him, that's a whole other kit and caboodle. I want to get into one thing, and I was just talking to someone about a child that had just, she had just canceled a lesson because she had her second COVID shot. This child is very, very young, a preteen, and she was too sick to go to her lesson. Now, this is kind of scary, what she shared in light of what the CDC has just admitted. Now, I'm going to direct people to this article. Please go to childrenshealthdefense.org and look for this. This is written by Megan Redshaw. The CDC admits teens vaccinated with Pfizer or Moderna are at a higher risk, now listen to this, of heart inflammation. Now, if that doesn't surprise you, I do a lot of reading. I'll even read VAERS data. I can only read so much because there is some. I mean, it's just massive. But if you sort through, if you do some of the sorting of that data, you'll find some of the indicators that this was going to come out. The Defender is experiencing censorship. That's what this news source is. So, you know, if you want to pay attention by looking at this, you can't, it won't get out to a social media. As CNN reported Wednesday, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory Committee now acknowledges a higher than expected number of cases of heart inflammation among 16 to 24-year-olds who recently received a second dose of the Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccines. Based on a May 24th report from the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, COVID-19 Vaccine Safety Technical Work Group, they call themselves VAS, the CDC on June 1st updated its website with the following language. Data from VAERS, this is what I'm telling people to go to. It's the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. Go there. Read it. It will shock and awe you. Please do that. Shows that in the 30-day window following dose 2 of mRNA COVID-19 vaccination, there was a higher number of observed than expected myocarditis and pericarditis cases in 16 to 24-year-olds. Now, these things should not be happening until you're in your 60s and 70s, people. They're happening to 16 to 24-year-olds because people are giving them to their children These are experiments. They are not FDA approved. And if the FDA approves them, the government should be allowed to be sued. The vaccine, and we say they know these things right now, and they're not stopping producing them. That's what's even scarier. The FDA hasn't said, shut this down. I have serious problems with the FDA with that. If you, again, if you go back and you read the VAERS data, you'll get even angrier. Please, please, please do that. Like I said, I try to keep up on a number of things that are important to me. As a result of myself not being vaccinated and refusing to be tested, I am not allowed to see my dad. Hear what I'm saying? I'm not allowed to see him unless it's through a window. I'm not allowed to touch him. Now, my dad's been in elder care for over a year. We're close to 2 years in elder care. And since this insanity began, and since he just moved into a nursing from assisted living to a nursing home, and I'm not allowed to see him in many ways because I will not submit. People do not submit. Do not submit. You hear? I'm telling people, stand up and make your choice, but don't submit. Now, in the midst of this this insanity, it's interesting. Facebook fact checkers, or should I say propaganda experts, were caught by the UK media. Now, I like when people catch people who call themselves fact checkers in the wrong. Why? Because I have yet to, I consider myself someone who will do some fact checking. But if I'm coming at it strictly, not looking at facts but at opinion, something's wrong. So the Daily Mail wrote an article entitled How Facebook Independent Fact Checkers Cited Letters Secretly Organized by Wuhan lab founder Peter Daszak to debunk leak theory and punish news outlets. This came. This is written by Keith Griffin. This came out the 5th. Facebook's independent fact checkers relied on a letter spearheaded by a major financial backer of the Wuhan Institute of Virology to debunk articles exploring the possibility that the COVID-19 pandemic originated in a leak from the lab. It has emerged. For nearly a year, Facebook censored articles exploring the lab leak theory, labeling them false information and punishing news publishers by limiting their reach on the platform. Before the social media giant sheepishly reversed course last month, Facebook relies on third-party fact-checkers to debunk false claims. In the case of the lab leak theory, a February article from the Facebook partner Science Feedback played a key role in the social media science. No, I'm sorry. See, this is in the UK. They don't know the whole story. They don't know that they actually have created an algorithm to stop people like me who share the truth. I'm encouraging, there's an algorithm out there and it's been exposed by Project Veritas. Oh, if you haven't seen it, go to YouTube, watch these videos or watch your late night news. This has been on the news. This insanity, people, we have to do things to get the truth out. Please, please pay attention. We're going to go across the pond today and we're going to go to I mentioned UK, but let's go to France. An attempt at an honor crime happened there outside a school. Not something you would expect. Outside a school. Well, France really doesn't have the concept of public schools because all of the schools are paid for by the government. So when I talk about a school, that is an important concept that you have to understand. There are no private schools. They don't have that concept.
all of the schools are paid for and financed by the taxes. Extremely, extremely important to understand. Now, this article comes from ActU Lion, ActU.fr. Lion, a punitive expedition leads to, basically it was an honor crime. They were trying to attack a Muslim girl. Now, this article came out June 3rd, and I want to tell you, it was a high school girl, Muslim girl, was being attacked because she was seeing a non-Muslim boy. Now, the families were okay with this. So it wasn't the family taking any action. So that makes part of this issue, you have to understand. I mean, I would tell you, you have to pick up my book, The Cancer of Civilizations You Have, if you want to understand why these crimes happen. I have a chapter in there on hatred, and it covers this belief structure, but it's extensive to go into for what I have left of the show. I have to say that they attacked these people who were not family members. That's important to understand also. These are not family members. They're not direct family members. If it were the parent, if the parents were attacking the daughter, you know, under Sharia, they could kill her. But because this is not a family member attacking, there's issues here. Because again, the parents have no problem with this. Now the issue is, are they good enough Muslims? If they're not good enough Muslims, then they're apostates, then they can be killed. So her parents, who said this was okay, are now being threatened with death, and they are now being accused of not being good enough Muslims, which would make them apostates, which would make them able to be killed. These are sad, sorry truths that exist in Islam. Just keep these young people in prayer, because the only thing I can do is say we don't pray that they would actually find Christ to get them out of this love of hatred, which is what I would describe Islam as, a love of hatred. This next article comes from Italy. Now, Italy did something this week that really surprised me. This week, they told a German NGO relief ship to get lost. Now, this ship is called the CI ship. It was docked at the port of Palermo after disembarking 415 migrants at a Sicilian port. So, you know, wait a minute. So let's read this story. It comes from FranceTVInfo.fr. This was the first mission of the CI-4, the Italian Coast Guard, blocked on Friday in the port of Palermo in Sicily. A rescue vessel for migrants belonging to the German NGO CI for non-compliance with security rules, they announced on Saturday. Inspection revealed various irregularities of a technical nature, likely to compromise not only the safety of the crew members, but also the persons who were or who could be in the future recovered on board during operations of help. Among other things, the inspection confirmed that the ship's life-saving equipment is sufficient for a maximum number of 27 people. Are you catching this? They had carried 415, but they were only legally able to help 27? Are they getting paid to move people from one country to the other is the question you have to ask when you hear that number of 415. Some of these things just sound insane. So this hospital ship of the German, again, it's a German organization, it's not the country, was moored at the port of Palermo after disembarking 415 migrants. Illegal immigrants. The German NGO denounced the decision of the Italian authorities. As for other civilian rescue ships, blah, 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 blah. You know, they said no to us, so nobody else should be allowed, right? I've already said my opinion. If these people want to go out and drown themselves in
in the river, the lake, or the, sorry, the ocean, then why don't we simply do this? Return them from where they came. Don't put them back in your country. That doesn't make sense, but that's what they've been doing. I just don't consider it intelligent, but that's the stories that's actually the sadness of what's been happening. I have another sad story out of Italy. Again, Italy and Germany are pretty close, so this story does involve a German girl. And you can find this in English on medforth.biz. This article is translated by Fred Lamenforth, Fredlund Medforth. Instead of the Italian courts deporting the criminals or jailing them, the migrants in many cases are given slaps on the wrist or short sentences. A 24-year-old girl, a student from Berlin, was violently attacked and raped by an Egyptian at a beach in Tuscany near Carrara, Italy. The 25-year-old North African confessed in front of the judge and tried to justify his rape. Her legs were bare. Okay, again, this is a beach. Her legs were bare. Any man would have done like me. He further blamed the attack on one too many glasses of alcohol. So you're a good Muslim, but not. Yeah. The bold rapist did not show any remorse for his actions. After all, if a woman is attractive and provocative, why should it be wrong to take her with violence, questioned the migrant. The judge has confirmed the arrests of the migrant, who had been granted a regular residence permit for work by Italy's left-wing government. In an out-of-the-ordinary decision, the judge deemed the Egyptian dangerous and lacking in self-control. The rapist is being held at the Massa prison until he stands trial. Unusual. How many times will they say, it's okay? Keep that in mind. We're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of migrants that have been flooding into Europe. We're actually talking in the millions. So keep this in mind. In Sweden this week, there was a girl with epilepsy who was beaten. She's only 14 years old. She was beaten incredibly bad, and they videotaped this, and they put it up, thinking it was funny. They kidnapped her first, is what I should say. Then they extorted money from her. And they beat her so bad that she had a seizure. Now, there have been no arrests made. Keep in mind, there was a video. I'm not saying that the Swedes don't have the equipment to find them or that they're not doing that, but I have to admit, it disgusts me. Again, these migrants are just, there's too many. There is so many. And these, if you listen and you read the article on samnet.se, you'll see that they're most likely Muslim migrants. And this is sad. There's a new article out by Jihad Watch this week out of Pakistan. I'm saying it's out of Pakistan, but this is regarding Malala. Now, I want to talk about this particular piece because I thought I like Jihad Watch for a lot of things, but this one pointed out some very important things. This is by Ashlyn Davis. Malala says education kills terrorism. One dead Muslim engineer turned ISIS jihadi begs to differ. Indian intelligence agencies verified on June 6th that Malala, I cannot pronounce her name, Muslim engineer from Kerala, who had joined the terrorist outfit ISIS, had died in Libya. His name, Abu Bakr al-Hindi, has also been commemorated in a document of the Islamic State entitled Know Your Martyrs. You're catching this. Is he educated? He's an engineer. he has been venerated as an Itish Shadi, which translates to a martyr killed in a war, or as ordinary people would say, a suicide bomber. Now, here's an interesting observation. Abu Bakr al-Hindi, whose real name has not been revealed, reportedly was a Christian by birth. Well, if you read the Bible, you cannot be a Christian by birth. You can be raised by Christian parents and make a decision. But you make that choice yourself, so you might be, again, let's get that through. Now, Catholics might believe something different, but again, that's not biblical Christianity. He was born into a prosperous Christian family in Kerala, which has produced many successful engineers. As a matter of fact, this Abu Bakr al-Hindi was also an engineer who was employed in Bengaluru, Karnataka, before flying to the Gulf to chase better career prospects. He found himself with a completely Islamic milieu in the Gulf and was introduced to Islam by means of a leaflet he was handed at a supermarket. He learned in the leaflet that Muslims recognized Jesus, which increased his interest in Islam. Subsequently, he discovered the speeches of Anwar al-Awlaki and was motivated by them to the point that he decided to convert to Islam, fly to Libya, which he could do easily with his Indian passport and Christian identity, and then join the Islamic State. It is safe to infer that this well-educated Christian engineer was only inspired to become a terrorist after he embraced Islam. Back in 2018, India's National Investigation Agency arrested 52 people for allegedly becoming ISIS terrorists. They were mostly engineers and postgraduates born in Hindu or Christian families who had converted to Sunni Islam. The Indian state of Kerala, which prides itself on having the highest literacy rate in the country, is gradually turning into the breeding grounds for ISIS terrorists in India. ISIS is training and recruiting numerous academically qualified Muslim youth from Kerala. Are you catching this? Now, the global sweetheart, Malala Yousafzai, recently earned praise for her much-celebrated statement, "With guns, you can kill terrorists. With education, you can kill terrorism." Why are these youth of exceptionally meritorious academic backgrounds giving up their bright ambitions and picking up weapons after being influenced and converting to Islam? Will Malala, a Nobel laureate, kindly explain? Oh, she won't. So the author did his own research. Here we go. It says, Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of the 9/11 jihad attacks, had earned a degree in civil engineering from King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah. However, his major area of interest remained religion at the university, and he was involved in interpreting the Quran. KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the principal architect of the 9/11 attacks, was awarded a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering by North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in 1986. Later, he discarded engineering and pursued a master's in Islamic culture and history from Punjab University in Pakistan. Abdul Rahman Yassin, an American citizen of Iraqi descent who was accused of constructing bombs in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, had a PhD. Hafiz Muhammad Saeed, the co-founder of the Islamic terror outfit Lashkar-e-Taiba, which has carried out countless attacks on innocent people, including the 2008 Mumbai jihad attacks, has a master's degree in Islamic studies and awarded the King Saud University in Riyadh. Was awarded by them. Malawi Hibatullah Akhundzada, the chief of Islamic jihad outfit known as the Taliban, is a religious scholar. He has been an instructor in Islamic madrasas, training over 100,000 students, and had also presided as the chief justice of Sharia court. So to say that more education it solves the problem, no, it doesn't. You know, you might wish it will, but it doesn't. And we're getting to my last few articles here. I'm going to talk to this one. This one, we just talked about the attack, the jihadi now in Libya. Let's just read this one. This comes from opindia.com. Christian engineer from Kerala converts to Islam and joins Islamic State, dies as a suicide bomber. Now, this is the same person we're talking about. Engineer. Was he a Christian? He says he was raised in a Christian family. Again, Christians believe, biblical Christians, believe you make a choice. There's no statement that he made a choice in any description of him. He was simply raised in a cultural family. Again, there's no statement that he had a faith in Christianity. There's a statement that he was raised there. And that's a huge difference to call someone a Christian or not. An engineer from Kerala who had recently converted to Islam, joined Islamic State, had been killed in a suicide bombing terror attack in Libya. According to reports, the intelligence officials have gathered information that the name of Kerala has appeared in Islamic State documents titled Know Your Martyrs. Again, this is the same guy. The concern is that this is a convert. And I want you to think about that. They're concerned that this convert, people are converting to Islam in Kerala, and that they are picking up and becoming jihadis. Now, this becomes a little scary as time goes on. My next article may strike home for a few people that I know that are listening. I shared an article earlier this week on LinkedIn and a few other places on Facebook. It's on what happened in Burkina Faso this week. Unknown militants, the NPR has the story. Unknown militants attacked a Burkina Faso village and killed more than 160 people. This came out June 7th, and it's by Jason Baubine. Now, it's a sad story. This is Freetown, Sierra Leone. They're reporting out of. Gunmen opened fire at 2 a.m., killing more than 160 people in the West African nation of Burkina Faso over the weekend, according to local officials. The assault on the village of Sohan on the Saturday, this past Saturday, is the latest incident in a region reeling from a recent coup and plagued by instability. Human rights groups say it was the worst attack on civilians in the region in years. Witnesses report that heavily armed militants executed members of a local defense force, killing civilians, destroying homes, and burning the local market to the ground. The village is in the dry northeast corner of Burkina Faso near the border with Niger. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Villagers who fled are now returning to bury the dead and clear the charred sites that used to be their homes. The country's president, Roch Kabore, has declared 3 days of national mourning. Government officials blame the attack on barbaric jihadists linked to Al-Qaeda. Yes, jihad. Is it a surprise? Let's stop calling them terrorists. Let's get this clear. They are jihadists. They might commit what someone might call an act of terror, but they are doing it for religious reasons, and their reason is jihad. Let's accept that. Now, what are they doing? And charge them with a penalty. If they are committing an act on your country, and they are a member of your country, they are committing an act of treason. Let them have that penalty. We are too lenient. We are way too lenient. That is the sad, sorry truth. And until we start to wake up, we're going to have problems. This next one comes out of Uganda. This came out today, and it's the last article I'm sharing today. A Muslim employer sends a hitman to kill Christian employee who refused to convert to Islam. This is from Christianity Daily by Anton Carrillo. Again, it just came out minutes before the show started. The Christian headline said that the incident happened in Africa and Uganda last month involving Ashifaro Kasani, who is also known as Kasani Jackson. Kasani was a transport company owner who employed Fred Isiko as a driver for a van. He called Isiko to meet him on May 22nd for some tasks for at work. Isiko, a Christian evangelist, brought along his friend Francis Maka to meet Kasenya, a former Christian who was converted to Islam in 1992. Now, he's saying for a Christian, again, their concept of Christian is somebody who is non-Muslim, who grew up in a family that may have had Christian culture there. Doesn't mean they were Christian. In 1992, this guy who kills them, who threatens to kill them, is a convert to Islam. The evening that day, Maka witnessed how his friend was murdered and narrated this during the interview with the Morningstar News. He said, when we met Kasenya, he gave Fred some money to go and buy some meat at Kadma Trading Center and bring it back for supper so as to have a business discussion the following day. As we were about to reach the trading center, three people stopped us. They said that they had some information for Fred. So I moved at a distance immediately. One of them removed a long knife and cut his neck, and I fled for my life. Isiko's relative also revealed that there is a May 7 recorded conversation of Kasenya threatening Isiko to be removed from his job if he refuses to convert to Islam. Conversation was said to have been recorded by Isiko secretly. You need to convert to Islam if you are to remain my employee, he said. Recording went on with Isiko refusing, and I should think about this. As a Christian, is there enough to convict you of being a Christian? Will you stand for your faith? Will you be strong enough? Is your faith strong enough? I have to say, the information I learn and the research I do makes me sad and depressed sometimes when I think about some of these horrible things. But I have, as a Christian, I serve the great God I am. I serve the great creator. And that's why I can do the things I do. He is the great provider. He does things that are just impossible. So I want to encourage you to, if you need help growing in your faith, that's another thing you can find at Amazon that I do. I do write devotionals. My encouragement is that you get in the Bible and learn more and strengthen your walk. A lot of these stories are sad. The real problem that I see with these news stories is that our news outlets in the United States generally do not report them. People like Andrew Herod and Todd Benzman in general are kept from telling the truth. Now, Todd Benzman has been on Fox News. I believe Andrew Herod has been on several news outlets. But you know, the problem is when you start to keep people from telling the truth. That really bothers me, that whole concept of keeping people from telling the truth. I received a warning from Facebook this morning because I put out a news story that revealed some of the dangers of COVID-19 vaccines. It was a headline news story, and I was told it's offensive. It goes against the community rules. How does that happen, telling the truth? I'm sharing a news story. In fact, I didn't tell anybody to make their own not to make these choices. I still have it. It's your choice. I'm not God. I don't make choices for you. And I want to say thank you for listening. I'm going to send us off with Courtesy Red, White, and Blue from this wonderful guy, Toby Keith. And here we go. For those American on Facebook listening,
American God will always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole of the red, white, and blue. Justice will be served and the battle will rage. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. You'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining.